Welcome to the Dungeon Plunger Podcast. My name is Jason Weeb, and this is the show in which I, a real-life janitor and dungeon master, teaches you how to plunge in and run a better Dungeons & Dragons game. Without further ado, let's plunge into this week's episode. Are you talking to me? Hit it! Welcome, Dungeon Plunger Union members. My name is Jason Weeb. Welcome to this week's show. I've been getting some strange calls, and I thought y'all should be aware of it. Strange calls, Dungeon Plunger? What are you talking about? Apparently, the MPS is really not happy with me. MPS? Who's the MPS? Allow me to enlighten you. The Mimic Preservation Society. Yeah, apparently, I've been getting complaints that I'm anti-mimic. It's not so much that I'm anti-mimic, as much as I feel like it's false representation. You know, you go into a dungeon, you're searching for treasure, and next thing you know, the like treasure chest is trying to eat you. You're trying to open up a door, next thing you know, the door is trying to eat you. I mean, with all the dangers in the dungeon, I feel like mimics just are like unnecessarily violent to the dungeoneer. Okay? Listen, folks. There's a lot of propaganda going on out there, and I just want you to be aware that Dungeon Plunger is on the case, and I'm not going to let you end up becoming mimic meat. Okay, that out of the way. What have I been up to this week? Well, I have been slowly working on an Ironsworn Starforged solo game, and hopefully I will be able to get that onto the YouTubes so that y'all can see that, but we'll see. So far, I have done my truths, I've built my character, and I just need to work on my sector map a little bit, and then I believe I'll be ready to go. I'm not a Ironsworn Starforged expert by any means, but I've been going through the book and following the processes, so we'll see where that takes us. It's like learning a new skill. I'm taking my own advice. I'm trying not to not play something just because I don't feel like I'm completely ready to do it. Put your money where your mouth is. That's what Dungeon Plunger always says. You know, in another lifetime, probably would have been cool to be like a Jack Burton. Could you imagine a Jack Burton podcast? That would have been great. Old Jack Burton. Yeah, that's Big Trouble in Little China. I gotta ask you, you know, what kind of nerd credentials do you have if you haven't seen Big Trouble in Little China? That is a classic. I'm getting off topic here. I continue to do my read-through of the Masks of Narlahotep 7th edition Call of Cthulhu game. And so far, I've finished the Peru chapter. I have finished almost finished the American chapter. And I believe the next chapter is England. Very informative. There's a lot in there. It's kind of crazy when you consider that the original Masks of Narlahotep is not even, it's maybe like 3/4 the size of one of the books from the 7th edition set. So they've really added a lot of information in there. And then there's book 2. I have to say, the book itself is really good. It's full color, and there is a lot of information. It gives you a lot of information on clues, where the links are between things, a lot of really good illustrations and pictures and, you know, maps. Like, the art in this book is incredible. Like, all these different faces or masks of Narlahotep that they show in the book are just, like, very inspiring. And they give you a lot, I find, in terms of what's good, like, good information that you would need to know for the various places that you're running. So, like, they give you, you know, the information that you need to know or that would be good to know about, you know, the geography of New York, you know, Manhattan, different places. They give you like a lot of street names and stuff about where locations are. And I think that kind of stuff really gives you a chance of like kind of making the place feel alive, right? I know it's a little detail, but to me, I think it's very good. Also, I've been printing off a bunch of zines that I've got that I wanted to talk about. I'm kind of excited about these. The first off, I'm not really big these days on the fantasy RPG stuff. My true love has really been science fiction or science fantasy. Growing up, some of my favorite movies were Star Wars, Alien, mostly Aliens, and that kind of stuff. I mean, I definitely fantasy was important to me, but I think my first love was always probably, you know, Star Wars and Star Trek. So the first one that I have here is called Kalorath, which is a little zine produced by Castle Grief. And it is basically a little rules RPG setting, kind of looks like maybe like a Swords and Planet or like a Swords and Sorcery style rules book. It says a role-playing game for 1+ players in a world of high adventure. And to me, I was introduced to this through one of the groups that I'm in that does solo role-playing. And I thought, hey, that looks really cool. So I'll like check that out. Other one that I got, and now we're moving into science fiction, this, you know, Cepheus engine compatible stuff. So basically Traveler 2D6 science fiction role-playing style stuff. And I have to say, I've really fallen in love with this concept of the 2D6. You know, once upon a time, I probably would have said that the D20 is my die of choice. But I'm really digging the D6 these days, and especially the 2D6. I like the simplicity, and I feel like it gives enough granularity to, like, you know, make the roles matter. So the first one that I have here is Hard Vacuum. This is a little zine produced by Boondock RPG Adventures. I was introduced to this particular zine through the Safeco podcast, hosted by Bob. He interviewed the author, Adam Kovac. So yeah, I've got this, the first two in what's supposed to be a series of zines, Pirate Bait Volume 1 and White Bear Volume 2. Little adventures. They look like they're really easy to like slip into your Stars Without Numbers, Traveler, easy to slip into your campaign, and probably easily modifiable depending on the system. Next up, I've got Scoundrels of Brixton, also Cepheus Engine compatible, by RPGRamblings.com. This company puts out a lot. I also have their Gary's Appendix, which is more of an OSE-focused zine. And I have, there's five of these, well, four Scoundrels of Brixton and another one called Scoundrels, which I'm not 100% sure if it fits into the same universe, but the idea is that it helps you make like criminals for your campaign. So I got SD Under a Hard Sun, SU Phantoms of Yunov, and SD The Clean Hands. Very cool looking, very well produced. I like them a lot. Lastly, I have Journey into the Madlands, which is a post-apocalyptic RPG zine. I believe that these are meant for more for like an OSE style, like post-apocalyptic role-playing. Looks pretty cool. If you look at the like the stats for the monsters, it looks very much like a OSE or old school style stat block. You know, you have like number appearing, the armor class, which in this case is like chainmail, but it doesn't give you a number. So I guess whatever the equivalent of chainmail is in your game, it tells you how far they can move, how many hit dice, the kinds of attack, how much damage. It gives you a number for a saving throw and a morale score. Very cool. I mean, the big reason why I got these is because I have long wanted to do a post-apocalyptic style game. The idea that I have had that's been sort of brewing in my mind for some time now has been this idea, sort of like the video game Borderlands had a baby with Keep on the Borderlands, in which essentially you had this Keep on the Radlands. Basically, the idea is that the players are like scavengers or, you know, vault hunters, so to speak, that are based out of this keep. And then they go into the Radlands to, you know, plunder, you know, ruins and vaults and, you know, get really cool weapons and fight really weird creatures. And I just had this vision of a bunch of heavily armed characters on dune buggies, kind of like zooming across a sort of desert wasteland. So I'm waiting for Kevin Crawford to come out with his Ashes Without Numbers. And that is basically his sandbox book on, you know, how to create your own post-apocalyptic world, depending on what kind of theme you wanted to do. and then all the tools you need to run that game. So I'm very excited. That should be coming soon. I know I keep getting updates, you know, as he finishes chapters to like give out as reviews and stuff like that. So that is the story with that. All right. So I did get some calls this week. So we're going to hit that. We got calls from BJ from the Arcane Alienist. We got a call from Che Webster of Roleplay Rescue. And of course, Jason Connerly from Nerds RPG Variety Cast. So let's dive deep into that mailbag, the phone call server, the memory bank. I don't know what you call it. I need to come up with some kind of cool concept for what you would call the like dungeon plunger sort of like call center, if you will. I don't know. But, or, you know, mailbag type of deal. Anyway, if you have an idea about what I can call it, you call in or email me and let me know. You can always leave a message on my SpeakPipe or email me at dungeonplunger@gmail.com. But let's get into the calls.
Hello, Jason. This is BJ Boyd of the Arcane Alienist. You know what? There's so many Jasons. I think henceforth we should all adopt Jason as part of our name. I think the J in my name henceforth will stand for Jason in solidarity with all the Jasons of the Anchorite podcast community. Anyway, that's enough of that nonsense. I just wanted to call, say I've enjoyed your first few episodes, and welcome to the community. I look forward to hearing what else you have to say. So far, it's been great. Lots of real, I like your stories of kind of how you come to sort of some of your realizations about gaming. So keep up the good work. And again, welcome. Great to hear your voice.
Hey there, BJ. Thank you so much for the call. I really appreciate it. Thank you for welcoming me into the podcast sphere. It's much appreciated. I agree. There are many Jasons. We are legion. As one meme that I've seen on the internet that has Robert Downey Jr. In Tropic Thunder, where, you know, he makes, I can't repeat it on here, but essentially it goes, "You never go full Jason," except he doesn't say Jason, but that's what the meme says. And I always think it's hilarious. I mean, I guess it's just it's a realization that the Jasons run the universe, but probably not. And I thank you that you enjoy my stories and find them useful. I worry that, you know, people will be like, what the hell is this guy just rambling about? Thank you very much. I've been listening to your podcast, The Arcane Alienist, and your last few episodes about the Black Sword hack, also being published by the Merry Mushmen, which is another little independent company that I think is really good. They've been putting out really great material. I think you guys should support it. I also found, you know, you talking about how it works as a solo game to be really fascinating. I'm going to pick up a copy of that very soon to add to my collection. So once again, thank you very much for the call in, and let's take our next call.
Hey, Weeb, it's Che calling from Roleplay Rescue, and I wanted to say big thank you for plunging on with episode 5. I was sad that you had no call, so I thought I'd call in. Wanted to say thank you for episode 5, and actually all for the others as well. And wow, I can't believe it's 5 episodes already. But also, I appreciated the general kind of feeling. When I read, "We don't need no stinking rules," I was kind of in a state of horror, thinking you were about to tell me that we're not going to use any rules in our RPGs. But your point was actually way more subtle than that and much more interesting, which was, you know, don't get hung up on that. And I thought you made some really interesting things, comments really around kind of how hard it can be to feel the pressure of learning it all, whether it's the module or the rules themselves or whatever, and actually holding back from starting, which of course has been your kind of theme all the way through. On the subject of Master of Nyarlathotep, I don't even know how you're supposed to pronounce that. Wish you luck with it, mate. I really do. It's a huge thing, and it would intimidate the absolute crap out of me. But I'm so glad that you're going to give it a go. And you're right, got to do it before you die. Might take you till then to read it. But anyway, I just wish you all the best with it. I hope that you have a blast with it. And yeah, game on.
Thank you so much for the call, Che. I really see you as a mentor and a friend. getting feedback from you is greatly appreciated. It really, like I said, you're the one that helped get me into this podcasting thing. And yeah, dude, I can't believe that, you know, look, I'm on episode 6 now, you know, so just one podcast in front of the other, one foot in front of the other. That is how it's done. I think, you know, that's been a big theme of yours that I've taken away is that, you know, little steps make big results. And also you really made me laugh with the, that I might die before I finished reading it. Yeah, it no joke, man. It's a lot to read. But as I said, I'm getting ahead. I'm steaming ahead and I'm making progress. So I'm not going to let that discourage me, but thanks again for the phone call and, game on, brother. And let's hit up our last call.
Hey, Jason, the other Jason here. Listen to your rules. We don't need no stinking rules episode. And I just want to say, of course, yeah, playing is better than not playing. No question about it. That said, and obviously you're doing good and what you're doing works for you. So keep on keeping on, my friend. But generally, as a rule, it is better to read the rules before, or not read the rules so much. You know, it's better though to read the module before you run it. With these big modules, maybe you can just read like the first chapter or two, right? You don't have to be an expert in the final chapter, but it depends because some like these sandbox kind of campaigns can bounce around. So I think it does behoove you to do a good overview of it before launching into it. That said, if the opportunity for groups is hot and you need to strike now and get that first adventure out of the way to hook them so you can run it, then do it, you know, and dive in. So I don't think it's impossible to do what you're doing. You're proof positive of that. But I do think it's probably beneficial to have gone through the material, even cursory like you did, before you start. As far as rules, though, to back up and to close this out with the second call, you know, you don't have to be a master of the game before running the game. But if you're not giving people pre-gens and your players aren't familiar with the game, then you're going to have to be able to answer questions on character creation, which means you're probably going to have to be educated on the skill system, the combat system, and the magic system, if there is one. So if you're familiar with those kind of things, you don't have to read the entire rule book. Like, you can skip the GM sections and you can skip the monster section and stuff like that, adventure design. But you want to be familiar enough with the skills, the task resolution system, combat, magic, and character creation to answer questions if it's a new system to everybody, right? But obviously, you can go back and catch up on the rest of the rule book when you have a chance. So anyhow, what you're doing is working, so you know, I'm not sure what you're looking for here. If it's just validation, then, you know, obviously it works. So I'm validating you. But, yeah, I don't know. I'm just calling because you didn't have a call, and I figured more calls are better than less calls. Anyhow, keep up the great work. Talk to you later.
Hey, Jason. Thanks for the call in. I really appreciate the solidarity, and I definitely hear what you're saying, brother. Yeah. Ideally, you know, we should read the rules. Ideally, we should read the module all the way through before we do these things. My argument was basically we shouldn't let these things or lack of reading these things stop us from, you know, running the game. Now, obviously, you know, I think running something as complex as like Masks of Narlahotep would probably be a very big mistake. You know, the game seems very complex, but let's be real. I mean, there are a lot of dungeon crawls out there that don't require that level of detail. You know, I mean, you can really run a game, you know, just by like skimming a lot of information. I mean, in fact, Barrow Maze was designed with that in mind, that, you know, you should just be able to pick up the book more or less after, you know, doing a cursory scroll through it and being able to, like, run the game. Essentially, what I'm saying is you run something in the meantime, and then you have, let's say, a week or 2 weeks that you can, like, sit down and actually read the books and, you know, get a better sense of, like, what's going on. When it comes to D&D, let's be honest, most versions of D&D share the similar DNA. So if you know how to play one game, or in fact, if you know how to play, you know, a bunch of different RPGs, you kind of know how to play most of them. Yeah, the details will be a little bit different, but I think worst case scenario, you can go through the book with your players and create characters around the table all together. I don't think you necessarily need everybody to come to the table with a character. So I think that, but you're right. Ideally, reading everything would be better. I really appreciate the call, dude, and really enjoy listening to your show, and keep on keeping on, my brother. All right. So with that, let's move on to the main topic. Today's topic is, are you talking to me? My mom says all the time, Jason, people who swear are not intelligent. And I swear all the time. I love cursing. I add the F-bomb like it's punctuation in my conversations. And so I think my mom is either saying two things. One, she's either saying that I'm an idiot, or she's saying you're not an idiot, so you shouldn't swear. I don't know. I'll let you guys be the decider on that one. But I do try not to swear on this show. I'm trying to keep it professional. And I know that there's people out there who have kids who might be listening with kids. And honestly, I've listened to some programs where the host of the show is trying to kind of give that, you know, energy of like, hey, I'm a man of the people and I just say it the way it is. And that's cool, but that's not the sort of image that I want to give. I do want to have a certain level of goofy professionalism, if you will. You know, I know that there's a lot of like younger people. I would like to me as a guy, 45-year-old man, I feel like I've learned a few things in life, and I would like to be able to share that with a younger generation. And I don't really think that me cursing would necessarily be the way to like go. What does that have to do with anything? I want to tell you a little dad joke slash real life story that happened in my life. My dad likes to tell dad jokes, okay? Ever since we were little kids, I always wanted to be kind of a comedian just because my dad was always trying to tell jokes, and I thought my dad was like the most hilarious dude in the universe. And so when he became a granddad, or a papa, as my kids called him, he would tell them jokes. And so he told my daughter this joke when she was, I don't know, maybe like 8 years old or something like that. And she went to school and she told the joke. And she came home from school one day, and while we were having dinner, she said, Mom, Dad, I got in trouble at school today. And I was like, oh no, what happened? And she said to me, well, I told the teacher a joke that Papa told us, and they didn't like it. And I was like, oh really? Because I couldn't see my father saying something that would be that bad. So I'm like, what exactly did you say? So she was like, well, I told my teacher, do you know how you catch an elephant? And the teacher was like, I have no idea. How do you catch an elephant? And she was like, well, the first thing you do is you dig a giant hole. Then you burn a bunch of wood and you take the ashes and you pour it into the hole. Then you get the elephant to come near the hole. And then once the elephant is very close to that hole, you kick him in the ash hole. I thought that was hilarious. My kids thought it was hilarious. Apparently, that's not appropriate for school. All of this is to say that when I was younger, and still to this day, I can be an ash hole. And that's kind of what I want to talk about. And really is about communication. Communication is the key to your role-playing game on so many different levels. We've got the GM side of things in which, you know, we act as the leader. We are the de facto leaders of the game. Is it right that the GM is the de facto leader? I don't know. But to me, it feels like tradition, and it does feel like you need to have at least one person who is there to sort of direct things around the table. So that takes kind of two forms. One is the leader of the game, in which, you know, you've got to be the guy who kind of tells, you know, sets up the story, sets up the pin, so to speak, and then the players come in and knock them down. And then the other side of that is the actual sort of like interpersonal relationships that happen around the table. You know, we're all people, we all have different ideas, we all have different feelings, and so sometimes our actions can be, you know, bring us into conflict with other people around the table. As a kid, I had a big mouth and it got me into a lot of trouble. So it's really no surprise that I would be podcasting now, because I like to talk. And because I like to talk, I don't always think about what I say before I say it, and I end up hurting people's feelings. And I definitely regret those things. When I was a kid, I was in the Boy Scouts, and I spent a lot of my time outside playing with, you know, knives, building fires, you know, going through the brush, doing stuff. And a lot of my sort of like inspirations for like what would eventually become, you know, my fantasy sort of style of doing stuff came through that lens. When the movie Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves came out, that was a particularly like rich time in my life. I remember my parents had gotten me an actual like bow and arrow. I'd made my own bows and arrows before that, but this was like a real actual bow and arrow. And I took archery lessons and, you know, we did all sorts of stuff. And that was because of Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. That was a great movie. I loved it. And then there was the time where I had read Huckleberry Finn and I'd built a raft. We had a river that ran through our backyard and I built a raft. And before I could actually like get the raft like actually ready to like sail, I'd had sort of like the frame built with these oil barrels attached to the bottom as sort of like the buoys. And somebody had came along and kicked it into the river and it floated away. Later on in the wintertime, I ended up finding it down the river frozen in the ice, and I could never get it back to where my house was. I kind of like lived in a little bit of a fantasy world in my mind. I did a lot of stuff by myself, and because I didn't have a lot of friends and because I did a lot of things by myself and because I had a big mouth, I don't think that I developed good ways of communicating with people. And I think that, you know, I was very abrasive in how I did stuff, and it made it hard for people to want to be my friends because of the way I acted and the way I talked, especially. Fast forward to later on in my life when I finally got a chance to like actually do some role playing. I'm playing in this game with my first game master ever. We're playing Ravenloft. Okay, this is Ash Hole number one. Playing in this game, the adventure was called Light in the Belfry. All right, this is a Ravenloft adventure. And what was really cool about it is that, and what made my game master super excited about running it was because it came with a CD. It was sort of like one of those almost like read along storybooks when you were a kid, where like the little chime would happen on the tape and then you would turn the page and, you know, look at the pictures, but the words were there. And man, I loved those as a kid. So this was a sort of the same idea, is that instead of kind of having read aloud text, you had a creepy, you know, narrator dude who would be like reading out stuff with music. And so Light in the Belfry came out in 1995, written by William W. Connors. Our characters, we're playing second edition, which this module was built for. So we're playing this module. I was playing a wizard. We had another character that was playing a paladin, and that was the only two players. It was sort of like a summer game. People were busy and he was just doing something to like, so that we could actually be able to play the game. This game master kind of came from the sort of like antagonistic slash kind of like player or GM versus player style of game mastering. And I found that kind of disagreeable. But as a hot-headed youth, I often would take it very personally when, you know, bad things happened. And it took me kind of a while to understand that, especially in D&D, that there was this opportunity for you to be able to, like, you know, revive your character through, like, you know, raise dead spells and all that kind of stuff. And I always kind of had this attitude, like, I'm role-playing this character and I need to play it like it's a real-life character. So if my character dies, you know, like, that's sort of like an upsetting thing, right? I didn't take it. I don't think you should get upset about characters dying. But at the same time, I still don't understand this attitude of like, oh, it's just a character that died. I mean, if you want to be kind of like, you know, actually role playing your character, then treating it like it's chaff to just, you know, like some sort of video game, then are you really role playing? And I feel like that may be where my mind was sort of entrenched at the time. Anyway, we were in this haunted house because it was Ravenloft. And of course you're going to have a haunted house in Ravenloft. Feels like the classic sort of, you know, I-6 Strad, you know, Castle Ravenloft type of deal. Anyway, our characters are going through this, you know, manor, and we get to this one, and there's going to be minor spoilers here, so if you don't want to listen to it, you know, skip a little bit ahead. Essentially, what happened was, is we came to a hallway. This hallway had a whole bunch of knights kind of like in armor, or not knights in armor, but basically armor of knights, statues sort of like lining the hallway. According to the book, there are 12 suits of armor. Inside the armor are skeletons. It says in the book that they are AC3, and that basically makes them tougher because they're skeletons that are inside the armor. And because we didn't have a cleric, we weren't able to turn these skeletons. Now, because there were only two of us, I guess the game master decided that only three of these statues were going to animate and attack us. Now, I didn't know this, but there were, as it's described, three glass spheres that were essentially like lights fixtures hanging from the ceiling. So my mind was that these glass globes of lights were the things that were causing these statues to animate. And that if we were to destroy those globes, then the statues would essentially, or the armored knights would stop attacking us because the magic that was powering them would have been destroyed. There was a lot of emphasis put on these spheres, these globes of light. And as it happened, my wizard at the time had magic missile, and I was able to cast three missiles at three different targets. And so, in my mind, it all made sense. Launch a magic missile at each one of these globes, and then these skeletons would die, and, you know, that would be that, and encountered past, and how clever would I have been to, like, do this. However, in the book, it says this. These glass spheres, bound together with delicate metal chains and hanging from the ceiling like an electrical light fixture, have been exposed to a fierce storm and thence absorbed a stroke of lightning. If anyone breaks one of them, he releases a lightning bolt similar to that created by a 13th level wizard, and thus it travels a distance of 170 feet and inflicts 10d6 points of damage upon anything in his path. And at this time, lightning bolts were able to like bounce off of walls and stuff. And so this is what it does. It bounces around and effectively, me and my companion were, you know, severely injured by this attack. Essentially a trap, a booby trap. It, you know, was clever, you know, in retrospect, but the amount of anger and vitriol that my companion, you know, lanced at me for doing this was just really upsetting. at the same time, the game master was just laughing. And I felt like the combination of being, you know, yelled at by, you know, this one guy who's playing with me and then being ridiculed by the game master and my lack of maturity at the time just caused me to explode. And I was super angry and I almost quit playing D&D because of it. That's how angry I was. And, you know, eventually I was able to work through it with the game master and with the other player, but it always will stay with me as a time that I really regretted not being able to control myself in, you know, playing the game. And I swore that, you know, I wasn't going to do that kind of, you know, be that kind of an antagonistic, you know, game master towards my players, that I wasn't going to be a GM killer or a player killer, I should say. The second time that I was an asshole, and I mean, there were probably many times, but these are the ones that like really stick out to me in my mind, was again, a larger group of players. But at the time I had gotten into drinking pretty heavily. I don't drink alcohol anymore. As my dad says, I am an instant asshole. Just add alcohol. That night, I had been slowly growing in frustration. One of the things was that when we first started playing D&D, and this was during the third edition era, we sort of had like a loose grasp of the rules. And as time went on and we became more and more aware of like how the rules worked and, you know, how the design of third edition D&D was intended, you know, we realized that, you know, there was a certain amount of treasure by level that was expected, and that there were all these different little like sort of things that your character should get, and sort of like identifying the flaws in the game system and, you know, adding our own homebrew rules. But it felt like the more that we clung to these kind of rules and character builds and how to like best create the ultimate character, you know, it felt like we talked a lot more about builds and rules than we did about actually like role playing. That really kind of like frustrated me, but also turned me off. I had been drinking pretty heavily. I was, you know, pretty buzzed. And one of the players brought up this idea that we should sign a contract as like a real contract as players that we will, you know, divide up the treasure that we find in the game a specific way. And up until that point, I didn't have a problem with how the treasure was divided, because as far as I could tell, it was all done very fairly. You know, we gave magic items to the people who could use those magic items, and we gave, you know, weapons and armor to those that could benefit from them the most. And, you know, whatever kind of like valuables, we divided up as equally as we possibly could, given the consideration that, you know, this person got X magic item or X weapon. And, you know, that seemed to be working. So I became enraged and I was like, why do we need to sign this contract? And maybe there was a reason, I don't know. But just for some reason, I lost it. And I really, really lashed out and got really angry. And it is probably up there with one of my biggest sort of regrets at like not being able to handle myself like a real person should have handled themselves. A lot of shame with that. And if I could go back in time, I would totally change that experience. In the end, we didn't end up having to sign, you know, we didn't end up signing this contract. I guess maybe I sort of felt like this was insulting, you know, that somehow people weren't being treated fairly. And maybe they weren't. I don't know. I didn't look deep enough into it. I was too self-absorbed with things. And sometimes these things kind of occur where I go with a gut reaction instead of actually stepping away from it emotionally and, you know, dealing with it like an adult should deal with these things. The third time, I felt like I was a real accidental asshole. I was running a scenario. This was during fourth edition. We had a brief, you know, sort of like time when we played 4th edition. And there's a lot of things about 4th edition D&D that I really enjoyed. But ultimately, to me, it just didn't feel like the D&D that I was looking for at the time. I had developed this game where we were playing in the Underdark, and the characters were on a ship on the Sunless Sea, and I'd stolen this idea from something that I'd read on Monty Cook's website on his forums, that he had been running an Underdark game for his players, and I was really inspired and I wanted to do that. They had landed at this Drow Island outpost on the Sunless Sea. They had gone there because they were looking to get resources because they had just escaped from an underground prison. So they were looking for like food and water and all that kind of stuff. And so they were like, oh, look, there's, you know, there was some kind of a battle over there. Maybe we can, you know, because they saw like flashing spells and lights and stuff. Basically, what had happened was, is that this was a temple dedicated to Lolth, the spider goddess slash, you know, drow goddess. The temple was there for priests, priestesses of Lolth to give birth to, you know, new babies that would be like sort of infused with Lolth's, you know, magical power. And another faction had come and decimated the temple, killed the priestesses, and made sure to, like, you know, also, you know, ensure that the newborn babies wouldn't survive as well. At the time, I didn't realize that my sister, who was playing in the game, was trying to conceive, and that the graphic nature in which I described the, you know, the scene was quite distressing to her, and she was quite upset about the whole situation. And I really regretted that, you know, I had, you know, done that scene. And if I could have taken it back, I would have, but I just was completely unaware. And at the time, safety tools and all that kind of stuff was not something that was, you know, well known at the time. It feels like this is a relatively new thing, the idea of having safety tools and X cards and all that kind of stuff at the gaming table. Essentially, there's a few things here that, A, I was young in one of these scenarios. I was insecure with myself and I didn't know how to communicate properly. Two, I had an issue with alcohol that I had to deal with. And three, you never really know what other people are going through. And because gaming is such a social experience, you know, we really need to take into consideration, you know, all of these different aspects of the game. When I became a nursing student, we spent at least a year in various classes learning about communication. And it felt a little bit strange that we spent so much time learning about communication. But when it comes down to it, communication is an essential part of being a nurse. The biggest thing that I learned was that it's not about the talking. I felt like I don't need to learn about communicating because I'm great at communicating. I talk all the time. And ultimately, that's not what communicating is. Communicating is the ability to stop, listen, and really think about what is it that this person is saying to you. You know, what are they trying to, like, let you know? And it's not just about what they're saying. It's not the verbal, just the verbal component, but their body language. I don't remember what the exact number is, but I want to say it's a very, very high number of sort of like communication and signals that are given off just from body language. Hence why running a game online is a lot more difficult than running a game in face-to-face, because you can really stop and take stock of what's happening around your table and address those concerns when you see something happening. As I was saying before, I think there's really two sides of game mastering. One is that leadership side, and the other side is actually running the game. And I think what's important is that we do a few things. So first of all, I think that as much as it sucks to recognize that as getting the group together is unfortunately falls on us, to sort of learn how to handle disputes at the table and, you know, between players and help to be a good mediator between these, you know, the players. I think, you know, sometimes it might be good just to say, hey, guys, I can see things are getting heated up here. You know, let's take a break and maybe kind of like sort through things, you know, because ultimately, you know, these people are your friends, right? And we come to play a game. We come together to have fun. And people have bad weeks, you have a rough week at work, you have a rough week at school, you know, you got something going on with your spouse or with your parents or your, you know, whoever. And we need to be mindful that people have bad days and they have bad weeks, and give them a little bit of breathing room and understanding to do what they need to do. You know, sometimes I ask the question about like, well, why am I upset about this? I found one of the things that I've really discovered is that really reflecting, and I feel like this is it's a skill that gets better the more you do it, right? You know, why am I upset about this? Why am I acting this way? Why, you know, and I don't think that it's something necessarily that's easy, but I think the more that you do it, the easier it will become to do. When it comes to running the actual game, I think that there's a few things that are important. I think number one, I think that we need to give everybody an equal opportunity around the game table to be involved in the game and provide their own input and let them be heard. And oftentimes you have players who tend to be the quiet people, and they'll sit back and they'll sort of let everybody else do the game and kind of dominate it. And sometimes that's cool. They just want to be there. They enjoy the company of being there with people. But really, sometimes you need, as a game master, to give them that opportunity to be like, hey, you know, what's going on over there? You got something that you want to add to this? And I think one of the best ways that you can do that is sort of like almost having like an initiative around the table sort of thing. Checking in every so often, going around like, okay, hey, player number one, you know, do you want to do anything special? What do you think? Player number two, player number three, player number four. And you can like break that up and start with a different player from one end of the table to the other end of the table. Maybe pick somebody in the middle and work your way around. Getting everybody to be involved in the game, I think, is important. The other thing that I find is that sometimes players want to be tricky and sneaky. And so they'll say, hey, is this thing in the room? Or hey, do I have access to this specific thing? And to that, I feel like sometimes these players, they want to surprise you as a game master. They want to kind of see like, how is the game master going to be able to react to this situation? And I like to ask the question, what exactly is it that you're trying to do? Let's not look at this as some sort of a competition, like, can I get you? And more as like a collaboration, you know, what can I say or what can I do? Because maybe we can work together and make this a much cooler scene than, you know, if you're like, haha, I outsmarted you. I think really that's what it comes down to, right? Is we've got to build this trust at the table between players, between the game master, that we're in a safe place, that we are friends, and that we're working together to do whatever it is, whether it's, you know, have that cool combat, have that cool sort of like war game, or have that cool story that we're trying to tell. Lastly, I think safety tools are important. I've slowly been trying to implement that into my game. I do have a little bit of a twinge in me that sort of like, ugh, you know, what is this safety tools things? We don't need no safety tools. But I do think that, and as my last point sort of like illustrated with, you know, what happened between me and my sister, it's that you don't know what experiences people have had. And I don't think that it needs to be something that like dominates the table, but I do think that having some sort of a like, you know, an emergency escape hatch, you know, like on an airplane, you know, we have these emergency exits and things like that in case something bad happens, right? And I think our games kind of need that too. In case something bad is happening that we need to like sort of evacuate quickly and safely from a dangerous situation, that we have these tools available to us. And so that's something that I'm trying to incorporate into my game. And I encourage you guys to incorporate into your game. You know, that's pretty much all that I wanted to say. I know this episode's running pretty long. It's probably the longest episode that I've done so far, but I did want to flip it around to you guys and ask you the question about, what do you think we can do to become better game masters when it comes to communication? You can send a voice message to my SpeakPipe or to my dungeonplunger@gmail.com email address. I just wanted to thank everybody who called in this week. We had our calls from BJ at the Arcane Alienist. We had Che Webster from Roleplay Rescue and Jason Connerly from Nerds RPG Variety Cast. Thank you very much, gentlemen. It is much appreciated. I also wanted to say, hey, if you guys could give me a rate and review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, or a like and a comment on YouTube, I would be greatly appreciative of that. The music is by Alexander Kizanaku. Cover art by John McNally from the Pacific Northwest. And remember, folks, when you're plunging into the dungeon and nature calls, watch out for mimics disguised as toilets. They're a pain in the ash hole. Elbows up!